Salon at 615 presents best-selling authors free to the public through a unique partnership between Nashville Public Library, Humanities Tennessee, Parnassus Books, and the Nashville Public Library Foundation. This Salon at 615 was recorded live at the Nashville Public Library.
Thank you very much. It was great to be back in Nashville. I was on the General Jackson showboat last night, and giving a speech while we were going down the river was really kind of cool. And we had 600 elementary school principals on there, so it was nice. And boy, they drink a lot. They were at the bar. It was really good to see that, you know. But it's been a long year, I'm sure, for them. So I wanted to give my thanks to the Nashville Public Library for this event. It's obviously a great series, and it's really an honor to be part of it. And Parnassus Books as well. I love independent bookstores, and I do a lot of signings of those across the country. You know, everybody loves independent bookstores, and you need to shop at independent bookstores so you'll have independent bookstores. That's just sort of the way it works. And I did an event with Ann Patchett a number of years ago. It was probably one of the most bizarre events I've ever done in my life. I won't name any of the people other than Ann and myself. I won't even tell you the city that was in. I don't want anybody to trace this back to me. But I went up there, and this was a paid speaking engagement, so somebody was paying me a lot of money to go up and talk, and I had my speech prepared, and it was going to be like a 40-minute speech, which is great. And I got up there, and my assistant was with me, and we were walking around, you know, where I was going to be signing, and I saw there were four signing tables with the names of four authors, including mine. So I was one of four authors. I wasn't the only one speaking. And I thought, you know, I'm not really great at math, which is why I went into writing. But I thought, you know, four authors divided by how many minutes? So I just slashed my speech down to like 8-9 minutes so that everybody would be able to talk. So we went in there, and it was a huge crowd. It was what an old mansion, and it was a lot of people in there. And the first person to go up, I will just call this person the offending author. And so she gets up, and they start a video. So she ran a 45-minute video of her career. And she was both an author and a TV personality. So 45 minutes, and we're all like, oh, my God, you know, that's like the entire allotment of time for all of us, and then some. So then she got up and spoke for another 45 minutes after that. And by this time, the crowd had mostly gotten up and headed to the bathroom because nature had called for many of them. And then Anne got up, and she was the next one to speak. And I thought of a lot of zingers for this writer myself, but I thought about them on the plane ride home later, so it really didn't help me a lot. But Anne got up, and Anne started talking about guns. How she'd grown up with guns, really loved guns, you know, wore a holster and shot stuff, and like every 30 seconds as she was talking about guns, she would glance over at the offending author. And I finally got what she was doing, and I thought, you know what, I love this woman. That is, like, so cool. I wish I'd thought of it. But so we got through it. And the only good thing about it was after the signing we had later, we all got up and we all went to the signing booth and signed, and not a single person got in the offending author's line to get the book signed, which I thought was very sort of poetic justice. Now, in book tours, I get questions from a lot of people. And the one I get more than any other is, what is it like to be a number one best-selling novelist? And I know the way they ask the question, they really want me to tell them, and I had this glamorous, super cool life. You know, I get up at noon every day, and I put on a smoking jacket, and I have a little furry dog under this arm, and a little furry dog under this arm, and I go down to my study, and I have a bunch of people waiting to write down anything I might say. My life is not like that. My wife will certainly tell you that. You know, I'll go to events, come back, and tell her, hey, this is really cool, da, da, da. And she goes, yeah, that's great, that's great. You know, it's trash day. Get on it. So in answer to the question, what it was like to be a number one best-selling novelist, I tell the people a story about my kids when they were little. My kids are grown now, but when they were little and my daughter was 5, I took her to a book signing with me for the first time. So we walked into the bookstore, and the lady who ran the place came over and greeted us and saw my daughter, and you know, she was thrilled my daughter was there. And she said, do you know why all these people are here? And my daughter said, yes, I do know. And why are they here? They're here so my dad can sign their book. And why do they want your dad to sign their book? They want my dad to sign their book because my dad has the nicest handwriting. You You know, she'll graduate from college next year, and I think she still believes that. That's why people come, because Dad has the nicest handwriting. Now, she must have passed this wisdom on to her little brother the first time I took my son to a bookstore, and he's kind of sort of like an entrepreneurial little kid, right? So we go in, and he sees all the books and all the people reading, and his eyes get like, you know, dinner plate size, and he takes off running across the bookstore. He's screaming as loudly as he can, "My daddy will sign any book you've got for $2. Doesn't matter who wrote it, Hemingway, Faulkner, I don't care. Just bring out the folding money, folks, and you'll get it signed." So that's what it's like, yeah. It's interesting, when I travel, and I travel widely, and I've written so many books now that it's rare for me not to be out and about where I don't see somebody reading one of my books. I can't remember the last time I was on a plane and didn't see somebody reading one of my books, e-book, paperback, or on a train or by the pool or whatever. I was even on a flight one time. The pilot came out of the cockpit, came down and sat down next to me and said, "I got a great idea for a story. You want to hear it?" I was like, "Man, you know, I don't know about you, but I like two pilots flying every plane I'm on." So I made a deal with him. "You get back up there and land this baby safely, I'll listen to your story." And he did. I did. The story was stupid, so we didn't do that. But so I have a rule about that. If I see you reading one of my books in public, and the rule is that I'll never come up to you for a couple of reasons. One, I'm a really private person. I would never want to invade someone else's privacy. And secondly, and far more importantly, if you're not enjoying the book, I don't want to hear about it. You know, that's what Amazon.com review boards are for. You can go on Amazon.com and anonymously trash any writer you want. I went on there a few years ago and saw that a woman had written a scathing review on one of my books. She'd given me 1 star out of 5, which is the lowest that Amazon allows you to give. And she was lamenting the fact that Amazon did not allow for 0 stars, because that would have been my fate. And she said, "My problem with this book is that I figured it out in the last 3 pages and therefore found it predictable." So the fact that I kept her in utter suspense for 497 pages didn't count for anything. But because of that review, I've changed the way I write my books, so that you may have noticed this, that the ending is no longer contained in the novel. On the back of the dust jacket flap is a 1-800 number for you to call. We accept all major credit cards. If you want the real ending to the story, so I won't be predictable. Now, So here's the thing with this story. LAX, middle of a book tour. I'm tired. It's midnight. I get to the airport, get off the plane. I would just want to go to the baggage claim, grab my bags, and just hit the hotel and go to sleep. So I'm walking towards baggage claim. And I see a guy standing in the middle of one of the aisles with his luggage strewn all around him. And he's standing there reading a book. And I thought my first reaction was, "Oh, my God, this man has no life. You know, he has no friends. It's just there. It's midnight. He's by himself reading a book." My second reaction is one of curiosity. As I walked past him, I was just wondering, what is this guy reading? Well, he was reading a copy of Absolute Power. So I remember, you know, you've got this rule, you don't go up to people. He looks normal. You got this rule, you don't go up to people. He looks sort of normal. So finally I thought, oh, you know what? What the heck? So I went over to him and I said, "Wow, looks like you're enjoying that book." And he said, yeah, it's a page turner. I can't put it down. I didn't even lower the book. I couldn't even see the guy's face. I said, "Well, I'm really happy to hear that. Would you like me to design it for you?" So then the book came down a little bit, you know, so I got his beady little eyes, and the guy's looking up and down in a really sort of unflattering way. And he said, "No. Why would I want you to write your name in my book? Man, you trying to steal my book?" I was like, I took a step back. I'm trying to keep this light and upbeat, and I'm thinking to myself, "You moron, this is why you have the rule, right?" So I said, no, I just saw that you were reading the book, and you said you were enjoying the book, so I thought you'd like it autographed, because, I said modestly, I wrote it. So the guy looks me up and down again, and he said, "No, you didn't." I took another step back. I am trying mightily to keep this light and calm and upbeat. And I said, "Well, ironically enough, Absolute Power is my very first novel. I am David Baldacci." So then the guy points a finger at me. I won't tell you which one, sort of middle of the hand. And he said, "Look, you freak, you're not Baldacci, and get away from me before I call the cops." Now, I can only imagine this happens a lot at LAX, you know. It's a strange airport during the day, much less at midnight. And for all I know, there's a guy in a white suit and white hair walking around going, "Hi, I'm Mark Twain. I'm dead, but I saw you reading Huckleberry and thought, you know." Well, by this time, a small crowd had gathered around us, I guess waiting for us to start punching each other. I'm a calm guy, I'm a nice guy, it takes a lot to get me upset, but this man had pushed my buttons way past maximum. So I said, "Excuse me." So I reached up, ripped the book out of his hand, flipped it around where my publisher conveniently put the big picture of me, held it up to my face, and I said, "You see, buckaroo, I am David Baldacci." So he looks at the picture, he looks at me, he gets a really sort of sheepish expression on his face. He reaches into his pocket, he slowly pulls out a pen, he's looking down at his shoes, he's chuckling, and he says, "Mr. Baldacci, what an honor." You know, what could I do? I laughed, too. I slapped him on the back as hard as I possibly could. And I said, "No, I won't sign it." But I did. I did. Because he got a great story out of it. I do, too. But I swear, if you ever are out in public reading one of my books and you see me, you'll never catch me. I'm out. I'm just gone. Now, when I was a kid, I was one of the kids that never shut up, which is probably why I went on to become a trial lawyer. And I'm suffering through that. My son just graduated from high school, and for 18 years, he's never shut up either. So my wife said it's all my fault, and I tend to agree with that. But when I was a little kid, I would tell these stories all the time. And my mom finally went out, and she got me a journal. And she said, "You know, honey, all these stories you talk about all the time, why don't you start writing some of these things down?" And I was like, okay, so I started writing things down, and all of a sudden it was like this epiphany, you know, these little printed symbols on a page that we call words and language, and I can do that to tell stories, and this is terrific. And I never really looked back. I just started writing. And years later, I went back to my mom, and I said, "Mom, what a gift you gave me. It's just extraordinary. It just changed my life." She goes, "Honey, that's really nice, but I just wanted to shut you the hell up. Because I'm your mother, and I love you dearly more than anything, but even moms need a little peace and quiet." And that's why I did it. But for me, it really did change my life. Now, wanting to be a writer and being able to be a writer are sort of like, you know, the old Samuel Clemens quote, the difference between the lightning and the lightning bug. So there's a big difference. And it's writing is an apprenticeship, you know. You spend years and years and years trying to hone your craft. You send stuff out years and years, and you get rejected and rejected and rejected, and it's just how the process works. And that's the way it's supposed to work. It's kind of like this gauntlet. I've always felt that the people who should be writers are writers because they're able to survive this gauntlet of rejection and everything you have to do to become a writer because they love it. And people ask me, "Why do you write?" And I say, "Well, I write because I can't not write." You know, I know that's sort of a double negative, but I can't not write. And if I'm not writing, I'm not happy. And for me, it's always the next story, and that's what drives me. As far as my writing process, I really don't have one, you know. I think that most writers feel like they have no idea what they're doing, and it's like they're writing their first novel over and over again, and you think you would have a format or a template or something that would help you along the way, but it's such a sort of a spontaneous endeavor that it's always different. I think it should be. Most occupations, if you think about it, you get really good at something by doing the same thing over and over again, so you sort of work out all the problems, mistakes, and kinks, and errors, and all that. Like, I would never want to be on a plane where the pilot says, "You know, I've flown this plane the same way for 25 years. Today, I'm going to do it differently. I wonder what will happen if I do this," right? Wouldn't want to be on that plane. But as a writer, it's really imperative that you do things differently, that you challenge yourself. And when I wrote The Finisher, it was a challenge for me. You know, I'd written 25 adult novels. And The Finisher really got me out of my comfort zone. And the reason I wrote it was because I loved fantasy as a kid. It allowed me to sort of just go into a world of breathtaking imagination and made me a reader for life. I never attempted it as a writer, and I wanted to. So for 4.5 years, I thought about this story. And I didn't think it really was going to work, because until it crystallizes, at least partially in my head, it's very difficult for me to write. And the genesis of the story came on Christmas Day in 2008 when my wife got me a blank page journal and gave it to me as a present for Christmas Day. And don't ever give presents like that to writers, because they'll just disappear immediately. And that's what I did. I was like gone. And I went down and sat at my desk, and I wrote the name Vega Jane in Christmas Day 2008. And that's really all I had. You know, I didn't know who she was, what she was going to do, what sort of world she was going to live in, what the story was going to be, what the narrative was going to be, the plot. And for 4.5 years, you know, with blood pouring off of my forehead, I could not make any of it work in my head. And I thought many times along the way that just I'm not going to get this book done. And then in June of 2012, everything sort of clicked, and I understood who Vega Jane was. And from June until March of the next year, I wrote 200,000 words, which is a lot of words to write. They sort of poured out, edited it down, and became the finisher. Now, when the book was done, no one knew I was writing this book, not my agent. The only one who knew I was writing it was my wife. And once I was done with it, I sent it out to publishers. I have obviously my adult publisher, but I sent the book out to New York publishers under a pseudonym. I didn't want to put my name on the book because I didn't want them to buy the book just because I had written it and they think I could sell a lot of copies based on my name. I wanted them to love the story as much as I loved writing it. So the name I selected was Janus Pope. And Janus is the Roman two-faced god. I was being very two-faced about this, by the way, right? And Pope, the surname Pope, was, you know, Catholic thing. So it's as simple as that, Janus Pope. And Scholastic loved the book and bought the book. And they thought I was a Brit, the way the book is written. So they wanted me to come over from England to meet with them. And my agent said, well, he'd love to meet with you, but he lives a lot closer. So that works out just fine. And it really has been an extraordinary experience for me. When you're thinking about kids and writing for kids, and this is a book that, you know, you could read. There's a lots of different sort of labels they put on middle grade, young adult, whatever. You know, kids middle grade on up to adults can read this book, because I knew from the get-go, having raised two very bright kids of my own, that you can never write down to kids. Kids are way too smart, way too savvy for that. So I had to bring my A game with this book, both in character development, plot, pacing, and all of that. When my kids were very young, like 5 and 3, I came down one morning and they had turned the television on and somehow they were watching the movie Jaws, you know, on TV. Now, when Jaws came out in the movie theaters, I was a teenager and I saw the movie, scared me to death. I didn't go in the ocean for swimming for like 14 years, you know. And that's how badly I was traumatized by that. And so I saw my kids watching this and I was like, oh my God. You know, this is going to ruin their lives. So I'm like running down the stairs. I'm throwing myself in front of the television to block their view. And that's when I realized my 3-year-old son is on the floor laughing at the television. And my daughter, who's 5, is holding the remote going, that's the stupidest, fakest shark I've ever seen. And I realized that what thrilled kids, you know, 30 years ago doesn't come close to thrilling or engaging them today. And what, you know, thrilled kids 5 years ago probably doesn't thrill or engage kids today. So with the finisher, I brought all the skills I had as a writer and a storyteller to bear on it. And I think that's why young people have enjoyed reading it, adults have enjoyed reading it. I've gotten lots of emails and reviews from people that said, I know this book is for middle grade. I'm 80 years old. I still consider myself middle grade, and I really enjoyed it. So that's the wonder of a story that can appeal to so many different age groups. Now, I do a lot of research for all my novels, and you think with a fantasy you just make it all up, but not really. I did a lot of research for The Finisher. I wanted to ground it in classical mythology, and there are little Easter eggs, I call them, throughout the book, where there are references and allusions to classical works of fantasy, like from Tolkien or C.S. Lewis or Lewis Carroll. Just fun stuff that's in there. And a lot of the creatures that are in there are sort of my variations of mythological beasts. And legends and fables and folklore, just jam-packed with that stuff, at least my take on it. So I had a blast putting it together. Now, for my adult books, I also do a lot of research. I don't Wikipedia stuff. I don't Google stuff. Anybody can do that. I try to go out and do as much as I can that my characters will do in the books. And I try to go to all the places that my characters go to in the books to the extent that I can. Now, a few years ago, I started writing a military investigator series called with John Puller. And there have been 2 books in that series, and another one's coming out in November called The Escape. Now, my dad was in the Navy, but I had never served in the military, so I needed to understand this world really well. So I had a friend of mine who was a retired colonel, Army Ranger. We jumped on a plane, flew down to Fort Benning, Georgia, where the infantry trains and where the Rangers train. And I spent 3 days down there basically getting my butt kicked from one end of the base to the other. And they took me right away to the parachute jumping grounds once we got there. And there are two towers at Fort Benning. One is 212 feet high, and you jump off with a parachute. For liability reasons, they would not allow me to jump off of that one. There is a God. Yes, that's great. The other tower was only four stories high, and it's a shack at the top with a door cut out like a door on a plane fuselage. And you're on a zip line on that, and then you go down to the ground via the zip line. So they let me jump off of that one. Now, before I went up there, there were like 50 paratroopers who'd come out for this event, right? And they put my crash helmet on, and they put the harnesses around my chest and the straps around my legs, and they were giving me advice. And one of them said, look, when you jump out the building, you're going to drop fast. And the chest harness will take care of itself, but it's the straps around the thighs that are the problem. Now, if they're not really cinched down tightly, they're going to move. And they're going to hit a piece of your anatomy you're never going to forget. So my friend was videotaping this whole thing, and so as I'm walking up the tower, you see me cranking these straps around my thighs back so tightly I had no blood flow in my lower extremities. So I get up to the top of the tower, and it's just me and the jump master. And he attaches the little cable here that goes out through this hole in the wall, and there's the open doorway and just open air. That's all you see out there. And he said, are you afraid of heights? I said, well, I kind of looked down the four stories, which let me tell you, looking up four stories and looking down four stories, it's the difference between, you know, being at the bottom of Mount Everest or the top of Mount Everest. It's a lot higher looking down. I said, well, not until I got up here, I wasn't. He said, okay, here's what you're going to do. You're going to back up to the far wall. You're going to get running start. You're going to jump as far out into the open air as you can. The farther away from the building you jump, the less you're going to drop immediately. You're going to need to keep your chin tightly tucked to your chest for the first 5 seconds of the jump. Tightly. And I said, okay, and why is that? He said, otherwise the cable is going to come around, it's going to take your ear right off. So I was like, check that box off, I got that one. Chin to chest, cemented. And it was like 7 or 8 months later, I was at a book signing, guy came up to me in line, looked military, trim, fit, you know, short hair. He said, hey, I heard you jumped at Benning. I said, yeah, I did. He said, yeah, me too. Pulled his hat off, turned around, didn't keep my chin tucked to my chest. It's like ear was half gone. So I excused me and went to the restroom, threw up, came back, finished the book signing. So, okay, chin to chest, I got that covered. He said, so when you jump out, you're going to be ripped violently to the right by the cable, simulating you somewhat jumping out of a plane. And you're going to be going at like a 55-degree angle, pretty steeply down. And there'll be soldiers on the ground waiting to give you further instructions. So I said, while I'm still in the air? He said, yes, sir. I said, okay. Now, the guys on the ground, the paratroopers on the ground, I found out later there was a betting pool going on. It was 99-1 that I was not going to jump. I was going to chicken out. The only guy who bet for me was my buddy, right? He also bet against me with a lot more money. And then on the videotape, you hear this one paratrooper, because it took me like 5 minutes up there to sort of gather the courage to back up to the wall. The only thing I could see that would hold me up was a little cable, and to run and jump out into the open air with no visible means of support. And one of the paratroopers on the ground on the videotape, you can hear him saying, what's he doing up there? Writing a book? Why, yes, I am. So I had to jump. So I backed up to the far wall, you know, and just ran. I jumped as far away from the building as I could. Chin was like, boom, right here. I swear, I felt that cable come around, like, back of my ear, tipped it, kept going. So now I'm jerked right to the right. I'm flying down the steep angle, open my eyes. Yeah, they were closed for a little bit. Open my eyes, and I'm heading at speed right towards a 5-foot-high, solid dirt berm wall. And I'm like, what idiot put a wall in the middle of me and the earth, you know? And then I suddenly hear people screaming at me from the ground, lift your feet, sir, lift your feet immediately. Those were the further instructions. So I lifted my feet past my head somehow, and the guy cleared the berm, and they grabbed my harness and stopped me before I killed myself. And before that, I got it back in my office, and the Army gave me a piece of paper that said, congratulations, you jumped. United States Army. Yeah, very proud of that. I'm very proud. Well, I also did the firing range with sniper rifles, and there you're firing a target you can't see with the naked eye. It's all scope work. And it's really weird when you fire one of the rifles and you manage to hit the target, which I did a couple of times out of many attempts. But you fire the rifle and you sort of count one Mississippi, two Mississippi, three Mississippi, boom, and then you hear the bullet hit the target. That's how long it takes to travel that distance. It was kind of cool. Then they'll put you in a Hummer, and they strap you in, they spin you around like a top, and they hang you upside down, and you got to get out of the vehicle as quickly as possible. The first time I attempted it, I got out so fast, the soldier who was conducting it said, "That's the fastest anyone has ever gotten out of that Humvee in all the years I've been doing this." And I said, "Yes, it was." Because fear is a great thing, you know, it's just a motivator. The other thing I did was and the most important thing I did, I just talked to a lot of soldiers, you know, everybody from privates to generals. And I wanted to sort of get into their heads and hearts why you do what you do. You know, this was back when the Iraq and Afghanistan wars were going hot and heavy. And most of these guys, and there was infantry, they were all guys back then, and they were 18 and 19 years old. And the way it worked at Fort Benning was you had 3 months of basic training, then another month of specialized training for some of the soldiers, and then you were on a plane to Afghanistan or Iraq immediately, in the line of fire, without exception. So I asked these guys, you know, young guys, why you want to do this, you know? And their answers were varied. And a lot of them were like, you know, we were attacked, I want to defend my country. A lot of them were like, this is the best opportunity I have to have a good life. I can serve my country, but I can also get an education, I can earn money for college, and I don't have that opportunity where I live now, so this is what I'm going to have to do. And it was interesting, and it allowed, you know, just talking to these people allowed me to write a much better book than I otherwise would have. Never would have Wikipedia'd this stuff and gotten those accounts, and I talked to these people face-to-face, and that's why the research is important. But you have to leave most of the research out, but the bits that you do leave in should be really important and should be really vital to the story and really flesh it out and add to the enjoyment of people reading about it, and that's what I try to do. Those are the books I love to read, and certainly those are the books that I love to write. Now, with that said, research can sometimes get you into a lot of trouble. And it happened to me one time, and I was writing a book called Split Second. It was the first one in the King and Maxwell series. And I was on the Amtrak Acela train in D.C. It's the bullet train we have for the United States. Compared to what they have in Europe, it's a snail train, by the way, but that's okay. And I was sitting at a table, I was sharing with two guys I didn't know. They were businessmen. I could tell that because they were in suits and had Blackberries and laptops and smartphones and miniature satellite towers and all that. I mean, these guys were like oozing business and capitalism. It was cool. And I was on my phone, and I was calling a friend of mine who was a medical examiner in the Bronx Medical Examiner's Office in New York, which is where I was headed. And she was an expert on this field that I needed to know more about to sort of write the book that I wanted to write. It's a very important subplot point. So what I wanted to do was set up an appointment with her so when I got to New York, we could meet face-to-face, which is how I like to do my interviews. Unfortunately, she told me that she was going to be leaving to go out of the country on special assignment. Sometimes she will take her special forensic skills, go overseas to work on behalf of other governments using her special skills for investigations. And she's going to be leaving before I even got to New York. And she would be gone for 3 weeks. She would not have communication back stateside. So I could either talk to her now or I would have to do it when she got back. I really didn't want to wait the 3 weeks. So I said, you know what, if this is the only time you have, let's just go ahead and hit it. So I had my question. I said, look, Doc, this is basically how I want to murder the guy. So I went through my really elaborate poisoning technique that I'd given a lot of thought to, let me tell you. And I said, you have to understand that when the police investigate this homicide, I need to make sure they won't know that I've murdered this person. She said, David, they won't. Really, it's a foolproof. It's like the perfect crime, the way you described it. I said, okay, but there's going to be a postmortem done on the body. I need to make sure I can fool the medical examiner. They won't know that I've killed this person. David, she said, I've often thought about murdering people. And she said, if I were going to do it, I'd do it just the way you described, because it really is the perfect crime. I said, well, that's high praise coming from you. Thank you. So I asked her a few more questions, and I ended by saying, I got to tell you, Doc, if I ever need to kill anybody else, I'm going to give you a call. And I clicked off, and I finished writing my notes, and I looked up. Now, the guy over here had spilled his coffee from his neck to his belt. I mean, he was like one big brown stain, not a happy man. The guy right across from me wasn't saying anything. He's just looking at me like this. And over his shoulder, here come the Amtrak police. Yes, Amtrak has its own police force. So I didn't make it to New York that day. I was detained as a person of interest by the Amtrak police. Let me tell you, you never want to be detained by any police as a person of interest. Now, the acknowledgement section in Split Second is a place where writers, you know, will thank people who helped them with the book. Now, the last acknowledgement in Split Second reads something like this. To any and all passengers on the Amtrak Acela train who might have overheard me discussing with various experts poisoning techniques for purposes of researching and writing the novel, and were probably scared out of their wits at my seemingly diabolical intent, I apologize. Yeah, I thought it was really fair of the judge to let me do it that way. So, the finisher was optioned by Sony Columbia before the book was even published as a film. Hopefully one day it'll make it to the big screen. There are going to be multiple books in this series. I'm about 3/4 of the way through the second one. And, you know, most young adult series, in the first book you see the whole world that you're going to be inhabiting over the course of multiple books, whether it be Harry Potter, which is a great series, loved it, or Divergent, or Hunger Games. The thing with The Finisher, though, is you've only seen a little bit of the world in the first book, and you have no idea what's coming next, and it's going to be more world in the next one, and more world in the next one. And for me, I could have, in The Finisher, gone about it two ways. One is I could have built a huge world and really touched on a lot of points very superficially, or I could have taken a small slice of a world that I created and really delved into it very deeply, and I chose the latter. So you learn about the Wormwood Village and the people in it, and you know there's something around it. You just don't know what else is in there. So you get a really in-depth look at a fantasy world that I just had the most fun creating, and it really was interesting for me at this point in my career to have done something so different and have such a great partner like Scholastic in the publishing process, because, you know, there are a lot of great publishers. Scholastic's a little bit different in that they're a for-profit publisher, but they have a way with books and getting books in the hands of kids, and that's a great thing. And I know from my own personal experience how much libraries have meant to me. I was a library rat growing up. I had deals with all the librarians. When I went there, they would let me check out more than the maximum because I knew that I would read all the books and be back the next week for more. And I grew up in a little town in the South and never really went anywhere, but I was able to see the world through books. And the only reason I'm a writer today, I've had any success at all, is because I was a reader early, and reading early is a reader for life. And every kid, every child should have that opportunity, because books make the best friends. They grow with you over time, and you're never alone when you have a book nearby. 15 years ago, my wife and I founded the Wish You Well Foundation. We support literacy programs across the United States. We funded programs here in Tennessee. And it's important for us because I've traveled this country up and down and all around, and we are the world's most affluent, most educated country in certain discrete pockets, unfortunately. There's a wide swath of the country where that is not the case, and it should be. So my philosophy is that all rising waters lifts all boats, and in order to make this country truly as great as it can be, then opportunities need to be there for everyone. And without the skill of reading, which for me is the most vital skill you will have, you really have no hope, no chance. Because for me, the verb to read equals the verb to think. You can't do one without the other. You can imagine yourselves in your life, you couldn't read it at a sophisticated level. Could you manage to do what you do every day? No, you couldn't. Could you fulfill your potential? There's no way. Could you come up with your own ideas about important issues and all that? No. And if you don't, there's a vacuum there, and there are lots of people willing to fill that vacuum right away and telling you what you should think and what you should believe because you don't come up with it on your own. So that one skill permeates everything in your life. Whether you believe it or not, it absolutely does. Everything that you do in your life starts with that one basic skill, because without the ability to think, I'm not sure anybody gets anywhere. We also have another program called Feeding Body and Mind. We partner with Feeding America, which runs all the nation's food banks. Now, if you're seeking food assistance, for a lot of people, that's because you have low job skills, low literacy skills. And we had an epiphany that let's tie books and food together. So when I'm out on book tour, I send these huge boxes ahead. My fans fill the books up, boxes up with books. We send them a FedEx label, and the box goes to local area food banks. So people going in to get food, which they need to survive, come away with books, which they need really to get out of that cycle of poverty, not just themselves, but for their kids as well. And over the last 4 years, we've collected and distributed over 1 million books through food banks. The You know, it's amazing. I've seen many bad things happen from homes that have no books in them. I've never seen a bad thing happen with homes that have lots of books in them. So it really does start as something that simple and that basic, and we will continue to do that. Because really, if you think about it, what a world we would have if all of us were readers. You know, goodbye intolerance, you know, goodbye prejudice, hello, realizing your full potential. It would just be the most, because then we're investing not in stuff, but investing in ourselves, in other Americans, which is what we should be doing. And it really lifts the country up to a level that would be unprecedented. Now, it's interesting, and I'll close with this, and then I'll take some questions from the audience. People ask me, do you get recognized a lot in public? And, of course, the answer is no, because writers are sort of anonymous celebrities, and we're not like movie stars or athletes. It's crazy we don't. Sometimes a name gets recognized, but never. I don't think people look at the picture on the back of the book. They just don't. But even when you do get recognized occasionally in public, it's not the ego stroke that you think it might otherwise be. The last time I was recognized in public, my wife and I were having lunch, and we were sitting in a booth. And I'm eating, and I happened to look up, and across the way there was a woman eating her lunch at a table, and a guy was next to her. And the woman was like staring a hole at me. And I was so taken aback, I just looked away, and I thought, am I crazy? Did that just happen? And I took like a minute, and I looked up, and it's like, boom, she's still there, like lasered on me. And this happened one more time, and finally I just stopped looking. I just focused on my meal, and, you know, okay, maybe this will go away. And then I felt a presence next to me, and I thought it was the waitress. And I looked up, and it was the woman. So she pushes me over in the booth and sits down next to me. I did not take this as a good sign. And she looks at me, and she smiles. And she says, you are who I think you are, aren't you? Kind of a weird sentence, but I said, well, do you read a lot of fiction? She said, oh, yes, I do. I said, well, you got me. Yeah, I probably am who you think I am. She's like, oh, my gosh, this is the greatest moment of my life. I never in a million years thought I'd have the opportunity to meet with you. I can't tell you what this means to me. I'm like, I am so overwhelmed. I'm just going to pass out. And then she turned and screams across the restaurant to, I guess, her husband. She says, I was right, Joe. It is John Grisham. I told you about the ego stroke thing, right, you know? Now, John's a friend of mine. We've done events together. I love John. I think the world of him. He's just the consummate Southern gentleman. That moment in my life, not really feeling the love for John. And my poor wife, to put it delicately, she blew iced tea out of her nose. I don't know if you've ever done that. It's not as easy as you might think, actually. I knew that she had done it because it all hit me right here. And she said very politely to the woman, you know, that's the right genre, but the wrong author. And the woman, to her credit, looked mortified. And she looked at me again and she said, oh my gosh, are you Baldacci? And I said, wiping iced tea out of my eyes, I said, yeah, I am. So obviously terribly chagrined that I was not Monsieur Grisham, she turned and screamed across the restaurant again to her husband, and she said, you were right, Joe, it is the Italian. I have no idea how my inflated head got out of that restaurant that day. It was just amazing. Thank you very much. Now, I've been glad to take some questions. I guess you got the rules on questions. Anybody have this one back there?
Where are we going?
Hi, my name is Ross. Understanding that you're not writing down, did you change any of your writing craft, and how did you get into the you know, a different headspace to write such a different to a different audience than you had.
Right. Everybody hear the question? Sort of how I wrote The Finisher was very different for me. It's amazing how sort of the perspective of a 14-year-old girl came very naturally to me. Maybe it was because I raised one and sort of no. And I also write, if you've read my other books, really strong, independent women. There are no damsels in distress in any of my novels. And there's a reason for that. I don't know any. You know, I don't know any. So, a lot of my guy friends need a lot of help, you know. But the women, not so much. And that's really what took 4.5 years of sort of head work in my head about how to do this, how to put it together, perspective to write from. As far as changes, the only change I think I would be, I made some different word choices than I would have made. Although I had to invent sort of my own language for this book in some regards. I call things differently, and some people might be frustrated by that. But in the second book, much of that is explained. There's always a reason for everything that happens in this book. And it might be explained in the first novel, but since it's a series, it'll be explained later on. But for me, it was, you know, the pacing had to be critical and important and moving. The subplots had to make sense. The character development, I'd made changes to that. I tried to develop the characters as deeply as I possibly could. So really, I think it was maybe some word choices that I made. The violence level was somewhat muted, although, you know, there is violence in this novel. It's not graphic. I'm more of a, you know, less is more in that regard. I let the reader sort of imagine things a little bit more, and I think it's more powerful that way. Kind of like the, you know, the bathroom shower scene in Psycho. You don't really see it happen, but you imagine it, which makes it even more terrifying. So that was really the only change that I made, was some word selections. Other than that, truly, I just did everything I would do in a normal book that I would be writing for adults. And it's amazing to me, too, that, you know, my son was in middle school, so 7th, 8th, 9th, even 7th grade. He would bring books home from school for me to autograph. And I was like, oh, is this for so-and-so's parents? He goes, no, this is for Jimmy. He reads your books. You know, he's 12. He's read them all. I was like, really? Well, I need to call Jimmy's parents and have a talk with them. I would call them up and say, would you like to buy more? No, I'm just kidding. It's so it's just kids are different. You know, they're a little more sophisticated. I did my commencement speech for my daughter when she graduated from high school 4 years ago. My son just graduated from high school, so they asked me to do the bookend, so I went back and did the commencement speech for his class. And I addressed them. They're part of the millennial generation, Generation Y. And all these stats were kind of weird and funny, and the kids really liked. But I was talking to them about, you know, what their lives might be like, and it's different. I didn't know this. I always thought the baby boomer generation, which I'm on the tail end of, was the biggest generation ever in the United States. They are dwarfed by the millennials. Millennials make up 80 million people in the United States. It's about one-fourth of the entire population in that one generation. And they're just different kids, and they think differently than past generations did. And one thing they have to be aware of, too, you know, a lot of people in the baby boomer generation, and before that, obviously, they would have one career with one company, they'd stay the whole way. That has changed for a lot of us now. But half the jobs that exist today in 20 years won't even exist, because of the changes in technology. So kids are not just going to have to change jobs a few times. They're going to have to reinvent themselves and their careers multiple times over the course of their working life. And I think a lot of them sort of realize that is the case, and their thinking has changed. And so in writing to them, I had to bring the best that I could bring. And hopefully, you know, it was good enough. Any more questions? I'd love to take, yes. And if you stop asking questions, I'll just start asking them of each of you. You know, I tend to get personal, just to let you know.
How many books do you work on at one time?
How many projects that I work on? I never work on two thrillers at the same time. I just don't have the capacity for that. Right now, I have The Escape that is in copy editing form, which means it's almost done. And my adult publisher, FedEx, that down to me in Nashville, is waiting for me at my hotel when I got here. So I've been working on that like half the time that I've been here. The other half, I've been working on edits that I'm making to the sequel to The Finisher. I don't count pages. I don't count words. I think those are artificial goals. I mean, I don't know who came up with 2,000 words a day, and in X number of days, I'll have a novel. Well, who thought of that rule, you know? What if all those 2,000 words are stupid? you know? But the 2001st was like, brilliant. You're going to stop? I have to stop. I hit 2000. I'm out of here. So it's kind of like Twitter, you know, 140, done. I'm out of here. So for me, it's I write until the tank is dry. And instead of going home and calling it a day, I'll move on to another project. I've written, you know, a novel and a script at the same time. We were filming Wish You Well a couple of years ago, and I wrote the script for that. And in between shots on the set, I was working on an adult thriller and actually parts of The Finisher. So it could be multiple projects going on at the same time. But I tend to just write and write and write until there's nothing left. Yes, ma'am.
I have two questions. The first question is, Scholastic accepted your book under your pseudonym. Who rejected it, or how many were they rejected? And my second question, as long as I've got the mic, who do you read in your spare time? And please don't give me Faulkner or Hemingway. Or, you know, you guys always have those little nice blurbs for the magazines. But
Faulkner,
really,
who?
Yeah, thank you.
First question, there were several that rejected it. In fact, the majority of the publishers rejected it, which was exactly, you know, that's what I wanted it to be. I wanted people to get into it because they loved the story, and some didn't. But that's just the way life is. There's no more subjective business, I think, on earth than evaluating creative material. You know, one person's gold mine is another person's travesty. So that was the way to weed out people who were not going to be passionate about the material. And it didn't hurt my feelings at all. Look, I've been through 15 years of rejection over my career, and they were very nice rejections, you know, stuff like, we're not going to publish this because we only publish talented people. You know, thank you very much. That was very encouraging. Constructive criticism is wonderful. I'll take that and throw it in the trash can. So I have my hide is bulletproof for that. But when you love to do something, this really is the process I was talking about, sort of the Darwinism of writing. Now, if you're in writing for the wrong reasons, I hate my day job, I want to get rich really fast, I want to sell the movie rights over the weekend, you know? And believe me, lots of people want to do that. You're going to get the first rejection, it's going to be nasty and cruel, and it's going to hit you right here, and you're not going to have body armor on, right? And it's going to kill you. And you're going to be like, I'm done with this, I'm out of here. If you love to write, it's like Kevlar body armor around you. And you get a rejection like that, and it stings like crazy, and it hurts. But it doesn't kill you, and eventually the pain goes away, and you keep on going, because you can't not keep on going. And that sort of separates the wheat from the chaff, actually, that gauntlet, which is what I was talking about. So, yeah, a number of the publishers rejected it, and some of them, you know, loved it, and Scholastic really loved it. So that was the process that I wanted to have take place. Books that I like, writers that I like, I was a huge, and still am a huge John Irving fan. And when I was in high school and college, he was my guy. He was just so cool and hip. Everything he wrote, you know. Garp wasn't the first one that I read. Cider House Rules was the first one I read. It was a brilliant book. Wrote the script for it. Won the Oscar. I was a high school and college wrestler, as he was. So I felt that sort of, you know, connection with him. And I'll tell you a funny story about John Irving and also about my wife at the same time. And this is why I don't write about damsels in distress. We were at the East Coast Oscars, which back then was in Central Park, a tavern on the green. And John Irving was there to accept the award for Cider House Rules. And he would later win the real Oscar out in Hollywood. So he was there. There was John Irving, like guy I idolized. You know, for a couple of years, I tried to write like John Irving, and I realized, you're not John Irving. So, you know, let him write that way, and you'll have to find your own voice, which all writers have to do. But I was so nervous. I mean, my wife's like, oh, there's John Irving over there. Why don't you go say hello? I can't. It's John Irving. She goes, I know it's John Irving. I just said it was John Irving. Go over there and say hello. I can't. Because, you know, I can't do it. She goes, oh, my God. So she grabs me and drags me over to John. She goes, John, I'm Michelle Baldacci. This is my husband, David. He's a writer, too. He loves your stuff. He's got a whole bromance thing going on with you. He was afraid to come over and talk to you. I dragged him over here. I'm sure you guys have a lot to talk about, so get on with it. I'm out of here. And she just leaves. So I was, like, staring at John Irving. He was looking back at me, and then we just busted out laughing. I mean, what else could you do? And he was like, women. I said, tell me about it, you know? It's like, wow. Who's the weaker sex? We both know. And it was just a great time, you know, and talking to him. Anne Tyler's one of my favorites. I, grew up in the South, so I really cut my sort of literary teeth on people like Eudora Welty and Flannery O'Connor, because I wrote short stories for the first 10 years of my career, and their short stories are some of the best ever. Truman Capote, the first nonfiction novel, In Cold Blood. I worked my way through college and law school, and in college, I was at night a Pinkerton security guard. And here's how the training went for that. I had to sign a waiver that said I will never tell anybody this, but that was a long time ago. So I went in the afternoon to apply for the job as a Pinkerton security guard, like at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. At 7 o'clock that evening, I was in uniform. And the only reason I wasn't carrying a gun was because I told him I didn't want a gun. He said, "Why wouldn't you want a gun?" I said, "Well, if I have a gun and somebody else has a gun, they see I have a gun, they're more likely to shoot me." They were like, "We don't get that logic at all." Well, that's okay. I do. So I was at the Pinkerton security guard, and I was at this electrical plant in Richmond, Virginia that I was supposed to make rounds, you know, and go all these cubicles and all these cubbies and these secret rooms and stuff and key in with your little key in thing. But every place you went at this plant would kill you if you touched it. You know, the guard who took me around before was like, "Okay, so anyway, if the power goes out here, you got to take this pole." So he pulls out this huge, long, like 18-foot pole behind him. And there was this chain across this bay. And he said, "You got to get down, you got to balance, and you got to use this, and you got to hit that switch over there." I said, "So why can't I go past the chain?" He goes, "Oh, you don't want to do that. Don't go past the chain. Never go past this chain." I said, "Okay, and so why are we using the pole to hit the switch?" He said, "Well, the pole will absorb most of the shock." So I was like, "Never going to do that. You know, not for $3.75 an hour. I'm not going to do that. Sorry." So I just sort of sat in the guard shack and read In Cold Blood by Truman Capote and scared the bejesus out of me. Great book. And really, that was the first time I ever thought about maybe I should, you know, mysteries and thrillers might be a forte because of that. So I read him, and I read everything. Walker Percy was another one of my favorites, and Mark Twain, obviously, read everything that Mark Twain has written and collect his stuff. William Styron, Sophie's Choice, you know, Confessions of Nat Turner. I was a reader early on. My first book I ever remember reading is called The Magic Squirrel. I read it when I was 6 years old in first grade. I loved the book so much that years later, I mean, when I was an adult, I went online and bought a first edition of it just because, you know, and it was like a chapter book with illustrations, but I opened up the first book, and I can't say that it was as exhilarating as it was for me when I was 6, but I could see why I was so absorbed in the story and wanted to get back to it when I put the book down. You know, that's just the magic of really, really great books. So that was a really long answer to very short 2 questions, but that's generally how I operate. So anybody? Yes, ma'am.
You have a couple of different running characters in your book. You have Roby and Real, and you have Maxwell and King. Who are your favorites, and are they going to evolve even more?
Yeah, I have several series going right now, and King and Maxwell were my first that I had going. And firsts are always a little bit special. I mean, I wrote a book last year called King and Maxwell, and it was great to have them back. I'd been away from them for a couple of years. Roby and Real are, you know, very fresh, very original for me. They'll be back. Camel Club as well will be back. I mean, the Camel Club is just a great series, and I really enjoy those guys a lot. And I had written, you know, 12 or 13 standalones before I ever started writing series. And it wasn't a conscious decision. It wasn't like I thought, "Oh, King of Maxwell is going to be a series." It was at the end of the book when I thought, you know what? These people have more juice, more room, more arc to run. And I decided to bring them back. And then I sort of did that for several other series, including the Camel Club. Now, the Camel Club, I did a lot of research for those novels. One of the Camel Club installments was called Hell's Corner. And Hell's Corner is what the Secret Service calls Lafayette Park across from the White House. And I asked one of the agents why they call it that. And he said, "Well, it's our jurisdiction. We have eyes all over it. And if anything bad happens in Lafayette Park, there's going to be a hell to pay." And that's why they call it Hell's Corner. So I went down there years ago. Remember those flip phones? Yeah, like little flip cameras, right? So I had a flip camera, and I had it flipped open, so I was recording. And I was walking out at Lafayette Park, which really, there's more Secret Service, law enforcement, all over the place, counter snipers on the roofline, you would ever know. It's blanketed with security. So I'm walking around with my little flip camera, and I'm choreographing the park in my mind, because what happened in Hell's Corner had to be really, really carefully crafted. Everything had to happen on the mark, on time, and everything choreographed. So I'm walking around the park, and I'm saying into the camera things like, you know, this looks like a good place to plant the bomb. And later I realized, you know, my God, are you lucky that, you know, you weren't tackled and whisked away and nobody ever saw you again. The even funnier part about that, that there's a guy down there who, he's at Lafayette Park a lot, and he's sort of dressed as like a Swahili warrior. He has a loincloth, and that's it, and he has a spear. I've had conversations with him. You know, he looks kind of crazy. I mean, you know, loincloth with a spear, so at Lafayette Park. But actually, really articulate guy and really knowledgeable, and I enjoyed meeting him. But I had not met him at that point, so I'm walking around, and here's this guy with a spear and, like, you know, huge dreadlocks and a loincloth, and that's all. And walking around, and I'm walking around with my flip camera, and I'm saying things like, you know, this looks like a good place to plant the bomb. And he's walking past me, he sort of hears me, and he looks at me, a guy in a loincloth and a spear, and he looks at me and goes, "You're crazy." I felt anointed somehow, you know, that I beat out the guy for craziness in the loincloth with the spear. So yeah, the series are important to me. I love revisiting characters and getting to know them, and I think that people like the arcs and seeing them evolve over time because, you know, you want that. Why bring them back unless something's going to happen to them, you know, personally, and they're going to have some growth, you know, setbacks and all that. So one more question.
I notice in your series, especially King and Maxwell and also Johnstone and the Camel Club, anytime the CIA or the FBI is mentioned, they're always kind of on the dark side. You know, I just wondered if they ever had you as a person of interest.
I am on so many lists you would not believe. I did a book called Simple Genius, and it was set down in Williamsburg. At Camp Perry. And Camp Perry is technically a naval institution, but it's a training facility for the CIA. So I had my assistant call the CIA's public affairs office. Yes, they have a public affairs office where you call up and ask them questions. So she called and said, you know, I work for David Baldacci, and he's writing a book about Camp Perry and wanted to know if he can't visit it, maybe he could talk to somebody from the CIA about it. So the response was, the CIA is very familiar with Mr. Baldacci's work. We neither confirm nor deny the existence of Camp Perry. Click, and they hung up. So she came back and told me that. I was like, well, they should take the sign, the highway sign, down. You know? It's kind of a giveaway. But the CIA, a lot of very talented people there, and they do a lot of... I'll finish with this. Let me tell you my intelligence story. I got a call from an agency, and they said, would you like to come up to our world headquarters in Maryland? We'd like to give you a tour. I was like, okay, sounds cool. So they sent a car, and I drove up there, and they gave me an RF badge, radio frequency badge, and that badge is loaded with your security clearances and emits sort of a wireless signal. So you go into a building like that that's secure, and they have transponders all over the place, and it receives that signal. So any place you're not cleared to be, an alarm will go off, and all the computer screens go black. So you can't see anything there that you should not be seeing. Well, I have no security clearances. So every room I went into, the alarm went off, and all the computer screens went black. So all the people working there are standing up, looking at, who are you? What are you doing here? And I'm like, you invited me. That's what I'm doing here. So they took me around to what they do, and it's really some cool stuff. They're pretty much a military support unit, but they also do stuff on the civilian side. For instance, let's say that the president is going to go to Seattle, and they will go to this agent and say, here's the motorcade route. We want you to 3D Seattle, and we want you to show us all the trajectories where a sniper could take a shot at the president on this route. And so they go in and 3D the entire city of Seattle using satellite technology, and they come back and they mark the spots where snipers could be, and the Secret Service put agents at every single spot along that line so nobody could take a shot at the president. They also keep the shipping lane safe so the ships don't collide together. You could have a tank brigade in Afghanistan that's on one side of a mountain. They'll dial them up and say, you know what, we think there might be some bad guys on the other side of the mountain. Why don't you let us know if there are? So they dial up a satellite, they look, they get firing coordinates to the tank brigade, And the tank brigade fires over the mountain and wipes out the enemy without even being put in harm's way. I mean, just amazing stuff. So it was cool. I learned a lot, and I thought it was nice. And then he took me to a conference room, and I sat down. There was like 12 guys and women in the room. They had all these big, fat binders in front of them. And the head guy was at the other end, and I'm waiting, really, you know, so why am I really here? So the big guy says, Mr. Baldacci, you ever seen the movie Enemy of the State? I was like, the one with Gene Hackman and Will Smith? Yes. Yeah, that was a great movie. That was a great movie. Really enjoyed that. No, it wasn't. You're right. It was awful. Just one of the, like, the worst ones I've ever seen in my whole life. And why? Why is that? He said, well, Hollywood and infant stupidity called the satellite agency that did all the cool stuff, like looking at license plates and following people everywhere they went. They said that was the NSA. Now, as any moron knows, Mr. Baldacci, the NSA are the ears of American intelligence. They listen in on people's conversations, as we know with Eric Snowden. We are the eyes of American intelligence. We were the evil agency in that movie, and we got no credit for it whatsoever. I was like, wow. You know, I kind of feel like I'm in a movie right now. He said, now, what we want you to do is write about us in one of your novels. You can make us as evil as you want us to be. And he said, let me tell you, we do evil a lot better than NSA ever thought about doing evil. He goes, really, listening in on people, we see everything. They listen. Who cares, right? I said, yeah, you know, I see your point. I'm thinking to myself, God, we're really paying taxes for all this, right? So I said, well, why do you want to be in one of the novels? He said, well, it helps us with recruitment. I said, okay, explain that to me. He said, well, everybody knows who the CIA is. They have television shows, books, NSA, they all know. So the best and the brightest getting out of college, they apply for jobs there in the clandestine world. And they don't even think about us because we're not in popular fiction. We're not in movies and TV and books. We want to be in books. Make us evil. People will find us interesting. We'll get the best and the brightest. So I was like, yeah, you know, I kind of see that. So I'll be going now. And I did write about them. I didn't make them really super evil, but kind of a little bit evil, you know, and I hope they were happy with it. I didn't hear anything back. So I'm sure they're watching me, you know. I keep my blinds closed all the time. I can tell you that because one of their satellite offices is right across the street from my office. And I just know they got something dialed up and they're kind of watching me, but that's okay. So that was my take on intelligence. They do great stuff. But when you have that many bright people working on agendas and trying to further those agendas, and sometimes we may not agree with those agendas, and there's responsible arguments on both sides, it gets complicated. It really does get complicated. But I admire what they do, and I try to present them in ways that I try to get the facts right, then I sort of spin what they do any way I want. You know, I can make them good, I can make them evil, I can make them sort of gray in between. They do both good things and bad things, which I think makes for really great fiction. But with the intelligence field, all I can sum it up and say is I had a friend of mine who was in the intelligence field. I had written this part of the story that I thought was way over the top. This is not plausible. So I said, you know what? I called him. I said, could you just read this part and just tell me if I need to dial this back because I just think it's way over the top. He goes, no, I don't have to read it. I said, no, really, I just want you to read this part and just tell me because I think this is just so implausible. It could never, ever happen. And I just want you to read it and tell me to sort of dial it back a little bit. He goes, no, I don't have to read it. I was like, why won't you read it? And he goes, simple. He said, if you can imagine it, we've already done it. Thank you very much.